It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll have our weekly check-in on national politics, including a meeting between the president-elect and high-profile technology business leaders.
First, President-elect Donald Trump and Vice President-elect Mike Pence's thank you tour made a stop in West Allis last night. The rally came just after the statewide recount confirmed that Trump had won the Wisconsin vote last month by more than 22,000 votes.
Jessie O'Poyan joins us now to tell us more. She's the state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times, and she covered the event last night. Jessie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jessie, you've been going to a lot of these rallies after, before the election. I guess this is the first one after, but how do they compare? What was the feeling like?
I was really curious to find out how it would compare. Obviously, Donald Trump spent a lot of time here in Wisconsin during the campaign, and I went to probably four or five of those rallies. The one last night, I was a little surprised to see it was actually really packed. Actually, a bigger crowd than some of the ones toward the end when it seemed like maybe people were less interested in going out to rallies at the end of the campaign season. So it was pretty full. Some people were actually there seeing him for the first time. They hadn't gone to any during the campaign. So definitely a lot of energy and people still pretty excited.
In terms of what Trump talked about, the content, what seemed to be the headline?
It was billed as a thank you tour. It was also sort of felt a little bit more like a victory lap, a lot of boasting about just the victory in general, some boasts directed at Hillary Clinton and Democratic supporters. Also a lot of jabs at the media, sort of a feeling of victory over the media, which he believed was disappointed and devastated to see him win on election night. So there's a lot of that. There was also some more policy-related discussions, I guess. He talked about some of the things that he is hoping to accomplish in office, like tax cuts for the middle class, lower tax rates for businesses, repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. He did talk about building the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. So some of the things that he talked about on the campaign trail did come back up in terms of policy last night.
And this rally came after the announcement of Rex Tillerson as Trump's pick for Secretary of State and closely after a Wisconsin recount confirmed his win in Wisconsin. Did he talk about those things?
He talked about both of those things. He is really not one to shy away from controversy. He noted that a lot of people, a lot of Democrats in particular, of course, are pretty critical of his pick of Tillerson because of his ties to Russia and Vladimir Putin. And he said that's a plus to him. He thinks that, that's an asset in the position, his ability to get along with other countries that the U.S. hasn't necessarily had a great relationship. So he said that's why I'm doing the deal with Rex. We need to talk about the recount, too. He said it was a waste of money, a waste of time. He was pretty triumphant about the outcome. He had a little fun dancing around. He'd call it a scam on Twitter. Last night he said he wanted to call it a scam, but he wasn't going to because he didn't want the media to be able to say that he called it a scam. So, of course, in effect, called it a scam again.
We're talking with Jessie O'Poyan right now, state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times, and she's with us to talk about President-elect Donald Trump's thank you tour, which stopped in West Allis last night. And Jessie, an interesting moment, at least with Paul Ryan and Donald Trump. There was a moment yesterday when Trump talked about Paul Ryan, and we'll let you tell us about it. But first, let's listen.
Speaker Paul Ryan, I've really come to I've come to appreciate him. Speaker Paul Ryan, where's Speaker? Where is he? He has been terrific. And you know, honestly, he's like a fine wine. Every day goes by, I get to appreciate his genius more and more. Now, if he ever goes against me, I'm not going to say that, okay?
Jessie, those did not all sound like cheers for Paul Ryan. I think there were some, but there's some boos there, right?
Yeah, this is something that started happening sort of in the middle of the campaign when that rift between Paul Ryan and Donald Trump started to become more and more evident, and in particular after Paul Ryan uninvited Donald Trump from the GOP rally in Elkhorn. That was the day after the Access Hollywood tape of Donald Trump making some sexually predatory comments had emerged. After that, you started to see crowds turn on Paul Ryan a little bit at some of these Republican events, and you'd hear boos at Trump rallies and when Ryan's name was mentioned. Had a little bit of that last night. Definitely not the majority of people there, but loud enough that you could hear it before other cheers drowned him out. But it was sort of a olive branch moment, I guess, on Trump's behalf to try to get the crowd on Paul Ryan's side.
And what did Paul Ryan himself have to say? How did that go over?
Yeah, he was he focused a lot on how exciting it was for him to see the state of Wisconsin give its electoral votes to a Republican presidential candidate, obviously for the first time since 1984. He joked he wasn't even able to drive the last time that happened. So he was excited. He didn't talk for a very long time, but definitely was sort of in positive spirits, I guess.
And another Wisconsin Republican who's had some friction with Donald Trump in the past, but who was there last night in person supporting Donald Trump as president-elect, was Scott Walker. What was the story there?
Yeah, so Paul Ryan and Scott Walker actually gave Donald Trump and Mike Pence some Packer jerseys at the end of the night, which I don't know, you know, if there's a better friendship gesture in the state of Wisconsin. But Scott Walker was there after Donald Trump had mocked him repeatedly on the campaign trail here in Wisconsin during the spring. Trump last night called him a great governor. He thanked him. He said, you know, he was instrumental in helping Donald Trump win the state. And Scott Walker said he was excited about the possibilities of a Trump presidency. He thinks that good things are going to happen with a lot of the things Trump was talking about last night, tax reform, national security, securing the border, are some of the things that Scott Walker listed as things he's excited about. He thinks that with some of the Wisconsin conservatives in power in Washington, maybe some of the things that have happened in Wisconsin over the last 6 years might make their way out to D.C.
Now, we heard a mixed response to Paul Ryan at that event because of past friction between Donald Trump and Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan, at one point, not quite pulling his endorsement, but not fully supporting Donald Trump either, and Scott Walker, Governor Scott Walker, had at one point during the primary said Republicans needed to unite to defeat Donald Trump. So did you hear any sort of mixed feelings in the crowd there for Scott Walker, or was that reserved for Paul Ryan?
It was really reserved for Paul Ryan. I didn't hear a whole lot of boos or any really for Scott Walker, but I would note there were some people who booed the Green Bay Packers, which makes me wonder if maybe there were few more folks traveling from Illinois last night than from Wisconsin.
And finally, it sounds as though one strand that has been tracked in the media since the election was the crowds chanting of "Locker Up," which had become a bit of a staple at Donald Trump rallies. And now the story is what is Trump's response to this? What was his response last night in West Dallas?
Yeah, he seemed sort of amused, and it happened a couple times, and it used to be that when that would happen, he would respond every now and then by saying, well, let's just win on November 8th, and he mentioned that last night, and he said, you know, this is what I used to say, but now we've won, and he didn't really go on to say, you know, so here's what I say now. He just sort of commented on the fact that people were relentless. He said, oh, you guys don't stop. He turned to Governor Walker and said, you know, people here are brutal, just kind of laughed it off and didn't tell them to stop, didn't necessarily egg them on, just kind of acknowledged it.
So how long did the rally in total last, the thank you tour?
Let's see. Trump's speech was for about an hour, and there was about an hour's worth of speakers before that.
Did you talk to anyone there and get their take on how they thought it went over?
Didn't get to speak with a whole lot of people, but I did talk to two gentlemen who actually were there for the first time. They were from Waukesha, and they had supported other Republican candidates throughout the race, but hadn't been to any Trump rallies, and they were won over, I guess, by the victory, and we're excited to hear him talk.
Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Jesse Apoyan, state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times. And she was with us there talking about President-elect Donald Trump and Vice President-elect Mike Pence's thank you tour, which stopped in West Allis last night.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the rural American experience has a lot more diversity than you might think. We'll look at new census data that paints a complex portrait of rural communities.
Right now, it's time for our weekly check-in on the latest in political news from Washington.
We're just a few weeks away from the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump, but he's been facing criticism for saying he would not take daily intelligence briefings. We'll hear about reaction from critics and supporters.
President-elect Trump met with leaders in the technology industry today. We'll hear some of the backstory behind the meeting in just a bit and what might have come out of it. And Hillary Clinton's been making the rounds on Capitol Hill as Democrats urge the CIA to supply the electors with a briefing about an alleged Russian hacking scheme in this year's election. In just a bit, we'll be talking to Francesca Chambers, correspondent, White House correspondent for the Daily Mail, about those and some of the other big news stories in national political news. We lost her for just a minute there, hoping to bring her back on in the next few moments. And it looks like we've got her in just a sec. Again, we're going to take a look at some of the top political news stories, talk about security briefings for Donald Trump and more. In the meantime, head over to the Central Time Facebook page for some background information on the topics we'll be looking at today, some ideas for leadership in a time of mega change. That's coming up in just over an hour. Four possible paths ahead for the Donald Trump presidency. Also a story on mandatory arbitration, some fine print that keeps people from suing consumers, employees, because they've signed their rights away, in effect.
We'll also be talking about rural America, taking a look at some surprising aspects of what being a rural American means. And the answer is there's not really one fixed answer to that question. And you can let us know if you want to share your experience, your reality of rural America. Maybe it's different than the popular conception. Let us know what that is. You can tell us your story about being a rural American on the Central Time Facebook page.
Looks like we're still having trouble reaching our guest for this segment. So we'll invite you to call in. What are you looking for from the Donald Trump presidency? Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What issues are you watching in the news today? We have our guest, Francesca Chambers, on the line now. Francesca, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, had a little trouble connecting with you. We've got you there. Let's jump right in now. Some of the news that dominated the rounds this week: in an interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News, President-elect Trump was asked about receiving intelligence briefings as he transitions to the role of president. Listen to that exchange.
I just want to ask you about your skepticism about the intelligence community. You are getting the presidential daily brief.
Yes.
Only once a week.
Well, I get it when I need it.
But is there some skepticism?
I get it when first of all, these are very good people that are giving me the briefings. And I say, if something should change from this point, immediately call me. I'm available on 1 minute's notice. I don't have to be told, you know, I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing and the same words every single day.
So he went on to say that he doesn't need these if he's in every day anyway, if he's in office for the next 8 years. So how did this go over, Francesca? Talk about some of the reaction to that.
Well, Democrats hit him for that, saying that he needs to be taking these briefings every single day. And, you know, even the White House said that this is very important for him to listen to these people who are giving him this information. His incoming chief of staff, however, made it clear that he was getting intelligence briefings every day. He just wasn't getting the presidential daily briefing specifically every other day, but still he was getting that every couple days, not once a week as had been previously reported. So there's that, first of all. And then, of course, you have a former acting CIA director, Mike Morrell, saying, listen, You know, this is a situation where the briefing is being prepared for President Barack Obama in the way that he likes to consume it, not in the way that it would be prepared for President Trump. And he could change the way that it's prepared for him in a way that he might find more useful once he gets into office.
Yeah, people have pointed out that candidate Donald Trump had been critical of President Obama for not reading some of the security briefings. Maybe on both sides, too much is being made over the exact format of a briefing.
Well, that's, again, certainly what his incoming chief of staff is saying, that this is being completely and totally overblown. And the White House, again, also saying that President Trump might change his behavior and change his perspective on this once he gets into office.
And then moving on, Donald Trump met today, as we mentioned earlier, with some leaders in the technology industry, the heads of a bunch of big internet and technology companies, not Twitter, it looks like. You'd written a preview of this. I understand no reporters were there, so we don't know exactly what happened behind the closed doors. But can you talk about the significance of this meeting, Francesca?
Yes, reporters were only allowed in briefly just to be able to see who was in the meeting. But there are two names that stand out. In this meeting that he had, Jeff Bezos from Amazon, who also owns the Washington Post, was there, and also Tim Cook from Apple. Bezos and Trump had a little bit of bad blood in the past because Trump had said that Amazon was getting away with dodging taxes, essentially, and then using the Washington Post to have power. So they certainly have a few things to talk about. And then, of course, on top of that, Tim Cook is someone who had raised money for Hillary Clinton, and others in that meeting had raised money for Hillary Clinton as well. And so I'm very much looking forward to see what they talked about after that meeting, which was ending just before we began talking on this interview.
And two points of conflict potentially as the years go by in the Donald Trump administration. Technology companies want these special visas to allow them to bring in foreign workers. Donald Trump has had issues, of course. Immigration has been a big issue for him, cracking down on it. And then these are all companies that are big on international trade. They transcend boundaries in a lot of ways. Donald Trump isn't wild about the current state anyway of a lot of trade deals. Do you see, even if this meeting went well today, do you see that there might be conflict here in the next year or so?
There's certainly the possibility for that, and something else they possibly talked about, given all of the discussion about the Russian hacking, is also cybersecurity. The Obama administration has tried to forge a very good relationship with these companies on that issue, trying to get the private sector to work with the government to try and identify these hacks sooner, identify some of this behavior, and figure out what they can do working together to prevent it and address it when it happens. But that gets into privacy issues as well, and that's been a source of conflict for this administration that probably won't go away for the next one.
Talking to Francesca Chambers from the Daily Mail, looking at some of the big stories in national politics, a lot of it, of course, related to the transition toward a Donald Trump presidency. You mentioned, Francesca, the Russian hacking allegations in this year's election. Democrats, including now Hillary Clinton and the White House, looking for more investigations about into Russian influence, some Republicans in the Senate as well. And now Hillary Clinton's campaign saying, hey, electors should get this information. They get a briefing about Russian influence in the election before they cast their Electoral College votes on the 19th. So what are they looking for there?
The Clinton campaign was frustrated the entire last month of the election, frankly, by what they felt was the lack of attention that the hacking itself was getting. News outlets were reporting on what was in all of these emails and John Podesta's account, and some of that information was damaging in terms of conversations that occurred between the Clinton campaign staff and within the Clinton Foundation. But they felt that the idea that these emails were stolen and that Russia was trying to influence the election, and as they said at this time, to influence it in favor of Donald Trump, that's what the Clinton campaign was claiming at that time. They felt that that was not getting enough tension at the time. And so now they're trying to bring more light to that and say, look, this is what we've been trying to say. And the Obama administration has taken the same approach to that, really highlighting this and saying at the same time that the news media should have covered it more from that angle and really putting pressure on the media as well.
And more generally, there's been a bipartisan group of senators, and it looks like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is on board with this, saying, let's not do a partisan investigation of this, but let's try to see if there was foreign influence on this election. Do you see that likely moving forward?
Well, it's possible that the Senate could come up with an investigation. The House could have its own investigation. Of course, the roadblock in the House, however, is that House Speaker Paul Ryan is not on the same page with Mitch McConnell about this necessarily, and about the idea that there needs to be like deep investigations into this. And so the White House has also commissioned its own review that it once done before President Obama leaves office. So there could be a series of reviews and investigations that look into this matter in both chambers and as well from the White House bubble.
And you've written about some electors looking for a briefing like the one we were talking about, 9 Democrats, 1 Republican in Texas, who said he wouldn't end up casting his ballot for Donald Trump. Even if the electors do get this briefing, that's not a sure thing. There's probably classified information that would have to be given to people without security clearances. Is there any sense out there that it's likely that anything is going to come out of the Electoral College other than, yeah, Donald Trump wins?
Well, Donald Trump is slated to receive 306 electoral votes. He needs 270 to win. So the people working against him would need to get 37 electors to not vote for him that are supposed to be voting for him. That's quite a large number, and it would be very unprecedented for that number. Like you said, there's only one Republican that we know of that would be planning to do that so far. A Harvard professor has said that he's heard from 20, which is not a number that's included in the whip count, and there's certainly not been that many that have come forward. But again, reaching 37 would be incredibly difficult, and even if they did, then it would go to the House of Representatives to decide, and the House of Representatives is Republican-run. So then Republicans in the House would have to determine whether or not they want to uphold the will of the people or potentially put a different Republican in. But I don't know that we're ever going to have the opportunity to continue having that discussion.
And we'll hear from Professor Lawrence Lessig on the show tomorrow in his last-ditch effort to change things in the Electoral College. And Francesca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a good time on the show.
We've been talking to Francesca Chambers. She's the White House correspondent for the Daily Mail. She joins us to round up some of the latest news from the world of national politics.
Coming up after the news, new census data paints a complex picture of rural America. We'll talk to an expert about the diversity of rural experience. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we find out how rural America is more complex than we might think.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is executive producer Erica Janik.
In 1895, the refracting telescope at Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay is the world's largest. As part of our ongoing series, Wisconsin 101, Kelsey Corrigan tells us about the telescope and the observatory that became known as one of the birthplaces of modern astrophysics.
This is the largest refracting telescope in the world, which is in Williams Bay, Wisconsin at Yerkes Observatory. And the telescope is a 40-inch refracting telescope, and it's huge. The University of Chicago built this telescope starting in 1895, and the project was completed in 1897. There are a lot of reasons, actually, why they chose Williams Bay. So the telescope was funded by the University of Chicago. It was actually chosen over 27 other locations, and the reason they chose Williams Bay was because it was still close enough to Chicago that people could technically still commute there. And what was most important about Williams Bay is it was outside of Chicago's pollution zone. And so there was no smoke, no light pollution yet at this time. So that was one reason why they chose it. Also, I thought this was kind of cool. The observatory was built on the tallest hill in a 100-mile radius of Chicago. Yerkes Observatory itself is one of the last observatories that was not built on a mountain. The people who made the 40-inch lenses, the company was called the Alvin Clark & Sons Company. They were an American-based company, but the lenses themselves, and they were actually made in Paris. There weren't a lot of places in the world that could make these lenses this big. That's why it was hard to make such huge telescopes, and why this 40-inch refracting telescope was seen as this huge deal at this time. The telescope in Williams Bay is a refracting telescope, but they're much larger reflecting telescopes. Early 1900s, the trend was that astronomers were using refracting telescopes, and astronomy was very popular with universities. It was a huge sign of prestige. So universities were making these refracting telescopes, wanting to get the biggest and the best telescopes. And then right after the telescope at Yerkes was made, the switch kind of occurred from refracting to reflecting telescopes. And the switch occurred because refracting telescopes have a couple issues. And the biggest issue is that they produce images that are blurred on the edges because the way they focus the light's wavelength, if there are different wavelengths, it comes in at different degrees and produces images that are blurred. So that's why the switch kind of went over to reflecting telescopes that don't create these blurred images. My hobby is history. I like learning about history, but my primary focus here at school is more science, biology, and just having this telescope in Wisconsin attracted famous people from all over the world, famous astronomers. I mean, Edwin Hubble himself was in Wisconsin doing research. And so the fact that this telescope attracted a ton of different people all over the world, and it really brought prestige to Wisconsin.
This story was part of Wisconsin 101, a collaborative effort to share Wisconsin's history in objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, for about 100 years, the U.S. Census has been categorizing American populations into rural and urban, and the divide between the two groups came under the spotlight in the most recent election.
New census data is showing that the experiences and political loyalties of rural Americans is a lot more complex than we might think. For example, only about 9% of rural Americans work in agriculture. David Brown joins us now. He's an international professor of development sociology at Cornell University. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, David, it seems as though when we think about what a rural American is, who that person is, we think about these lonely Western states. We think about probably white people working in agriculture. How accurate is that image?
Well, that's accurate for some parts of the U.S., but not for others of the rural in the U.S. So outside of the South, the rural population is largely white, but that's changing, especially as the Hispanic population moves from the Southwest into the Midwest and the Southeast, primarily attracted by various aspects of food processing and construction and other industries. I think the main thing to understand is that the rural population is extremely diverse, and so you can find all kinds of people doing all kinds of jobs throughout rural America, but some of them are more concentrated in certain regions other than others.
So when we hear the phrase on election night, for instance, the word white lash to talk about the vote in rural America that may have gone in large part to Donald Trump, you're talking about a diversity that might not be reflected in that word. Can you tell us more about what that diversity looks like in America?
Well, the diversity, I think this whole the political aspect that you're getting at here, I think really does focus more on the rural population in the Midwest, Midwestern part of the United States. This wouldn't be the case in the South. The South is already going to vote Republican primarily, but that's not the case in places that have heavy African-American population. So if you look at the rural population in the southern United States, There are many counties with 70% or more population rural, so those are not going to be rural places that heavily favor Republicans, or that, more important for this election, switched from having voted Democrat to voting Republican. So I think what's going on, especially in the rural Midwest, is that you have people who are in communities that have lost major employers, especially manufacturing employers, and or in places where agriculture has really changed. The amount of agricultural production may not have declined, but the number of people working in it and the number of farms would have declined through concentration. So for many of these people, the loss of manufacturing jobs started probably in the 1960s and has been accelerated by globalization. And many people believe that these jobs will never come back, and that they tend to have a sense of hopelessness, people who work in these industries. And many people believe that many of these people feel disrespected and ignored by the political establishment. And so by the time you get to 2016, we're through their recession. Urban areas recovered better than rural areas in the recession. And so it's kind of a perfect storm with respect to the white rural vote, especially those people who had been employed in manufacturing and in agriculture, but who no longer are. It's not that they aren't employed, but many of these people are employed in jobs that pay less than they were used to having, and in jobs that really, to be quite honest, don't have a job ladder or career ladder that would lead them from their current situation into a better economic situation.
Now, when we talk about population specifically, I mean, it hasn't always been true that more Americans live in these urban centers than live in rural areas of the state. When did that start to change?
Well, the last census nationwide, U.S.-wide, when the rural population was a half or more of the total population, was 1910. So the 1920 census really was the first census in which more than 50% of the U.S. population lived in urban areas. But again, even though the rural population in the U.S. overall is about 19% of the population, like you said at the top of the show, it's the percentage of the population in different regions that's rural is quite different. So in the Midwest, for example, about 28% of all people are rural. And so, and if you look at the Northeast, it's less than 10%. So that 19% measure across the entire country really varies quite a bit. But certainly by the time you get into the 50s and 60s, you know, in the 50s after the Second World War, you're really getting into situations with 70% or more of the population in urban areas.
Now, the divide that we've been starting to get at between urban and rural communities seemed especially polarized and stark during this last election. When did that development start to take place, or has it always been that way a little bit?
Well, I'm not a political sociologist, and so I'll take a stab at your question, but I'm not completely sure I'm going to have the right answer. Perhaps some of the call-in, the people that call in, would give us some more focus on this. As I said before, starting somewhere around the 1960s, the organization of economic life in rural areas really started to be transformed, and the percentage working in agriculture declined dramatically, primarily because of mechanization, and the percentage employed in manufacturing also started to decline. And so I don't think most people realize that the dependence on manufacturing really started to go down, you know, over 50 years ago. Now, that has been accelerated by globalization, and globalization leads to what a lot of people call offshoring of jobs, and that's the loss of jobs to other countries that pay lower wages, have less worker protection, et cetera. So this long-term trend of the loss of manufacturing in the U.S. in general and in the rural U.S. was really accelerated by globalization. So I think that you know, that this really has led to a significant discontent among people who had been in manufacturing and who expected their children to be able to follow them into manufacturing and to earn, you know, well-paying jobs that had really good prospects for economic security. So if I had to guess, I would say, and again, some of this transformation hits rural areas more squarely than in urban areas. So if I had to guess, I would say this discontent between rural and urban areas probably started somewhere in the 80s, you know, mid to late 80s, and has been accelerating as globalization became deeper and deeper and deeper and hollowed out the middle of rural American jobs more and more and more.
We're talking right now about different kinds of rural communities, of rural experience across America right now with David Brown. He's International Professor of Development Sociology at Cornell University.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this your community our guest is describing? Have you seen this change, decline in jobs in agriculture and local manufacturing in your rural part of the state or neighboring states of Wisconsin? And did you feel like the candidates, the parties, talked to you and your concerns in this last election? Call 800-642-1234. Let us know what misconceptions people have about rural Wisconsin, about rural America. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up the conversation with David Brown. He's an international professor of development sociology at Cornell University, and we're looking at new census data that paints a more nuanced picture of rural America than we might expect.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you live or have lived in a rural part of the state, of the country. What do you think about this? Do you think people have misconceptions about what's going on in your community? What are the challenges, economic and otherwise, facing your community? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take our first caller now. We've got Brett joining us in Madison. Brett, hi.
Hi. You know, I'm an emergency medicine physician. I've worked in urban ERs in Chicago, New York City. I now work at a ER in a rural area in Wisconsin. And I definitely see, you know, over the last several years, I've been working what your guest has talked about, where people are just not able to achieve the same standard of living as their parents were. And, you know, it has a lot of ramifications that we see in the ER. People are showing up with all kinds of issues of addiction, anxiety, depression, chronic health issues that they can't get a hold of because they can't, you know, afford to make nutrition and exercise a part of their normal life because they're working three different jobs. Some of them are at night shift. They're taking care of their elderly parents. It's really a mess out there in both the urban and the rural areas. And so I see what he's saying. I think he's right on point and that, you know, we've got to find a way to help these people get decent paying jobs in order to kind of help shore up the fabric of our society.
Brent, thanks a lot for that perspective. Interesting. And David, we haven't talked yet about poverty, but we can talk a little bit first about services, healthcare, and how that ties into the wages. How do you see this all weaving together?
Okay, well, I'm glad Brent brought that up because this whole issue of access to services is really a major dynamic in rural America. And again, this is not a new trend. This has been happening increasingly over time. Well, the first thing I would say is that if you look at the jobs that people have in rural America at the present time, they tend to be concentrated in services, just like the rest of the country. And the kinds of services that people are most likely to have jobs in rural areas are in education, healthcare, and social services. Again, that is not that much different than urban areas. They may make a somewhat less in terms of wages, but nonetheless, the kinds of employment look pretty similar. But I want to pick up on something that Brent alluded to, but hasn't come up yet. And again, this doesn't have anything to do with the election and the demographics of the election and the rural aspect of that. But it's really one of the biggest issues for the biggest challenges for rural America, and that's the whole idea of population aging. And so if you look at the age of the population in the United States, rural areas on average are about 15 years older than their urban counterparts. So in other words, the median age of rural America is somewhere in the vicinity, somewhere I have it written down actually, I can tell you exactly, 43 years, and the average age of urban areas is 36 years. Now that's really substantial, that difference. And that difference really comes into play in rural areas, especially with respect to access to services and particularly health services. So Brent said that he works in EMS and in emergency rooms. It turns out that there are a lot of rural areas that have very old populations that have extremely low access to services. They have very little public transportation to get people to services outside of their immediate community. And, you know, it's really one of the most troubling issues that rural America is facing at the present time. One thing that's kind of strange, and I'm actually doing research on this at the present time, is that there are some technologies that can diminish the effects of being in a rural area and not having, you know, say, specialty medicine in your locale. And that's telemedicine, for example, or the use of other kinds of technologies. But many communities do not adopt this technology. And we're not really sure why. Is it because they can't afford it? Is it because people wouldn't accept it? And so that's one of the questions that I'm actually looking at in my current research, why communities don't adopt technology that could diminish the disadvantage of being in a rural area with poor public transportation and no specialty medical services available. So population aging is a big deal.
Brett, thank you so much for that phone call. And we're talking right now with David Brown from Cornell University, talking about different realities of rural experience in America. And we'll take another call here. We've got Jade joining us from Westfield. Jade, hi.
Hi, friends. How are you guys?
Good. How about you?
Good. I'm doing well. Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your input. It's very insightful. And I just wanted to throw a few things in there. I'm 39 years old. I grew up in Wisconsin, grew up in Milwaukee, and kind of left when I was about 18, went around the world. I'm a chef by trade, and I worked in some really amazing markets. I spent many years in Manhattan. I spent a good amount of time in Boulder, Colorado, which are two pretty interesting and very different markets than the Midwest and Wisconsin in general. About 10 years ago, I took my skill set and my strong suits and started to focus in agriculture and got my first farm. Small farm, about 3 acres. From there, I moved up a few times, and I've had a few farms. One of the biggest, I think, concepts is that increasingly our food is coming from further and further away. Whether we talk about manufacturing or agriculture, globalism is taking over in a lot of different ways and having major impacts. One of them is that, as we know, our food travels thousands and thousands of miles, and there's very little traceability. I focus.
I think we lost you, Jay, but I get where you're going there with that call, pointing to, I think, a resurgence in small-scale agriculture, maybe an agriculture farming renaissance in some of these rural communities, and maybe that being a route to bringing some of the upward-pointing incomes back in those rural areas of the state. David, do you see that happening? A short answer, please,
absolutely.
As we get closer.
I'm really glad that Jay brought that up. I'm concerned about painting a tale of woe here, that everything is terrible in rural America and it's going to hell in a handbasket, because there really are some aspects of current situations in rural areas that are quite bright. And I think this whole issue of reducing food miles, that's kind of the jargon for this, how far your food travels, by depending more on locally grown commodities is really important, and it provides a good living for small farmers who can market directly to consumers, to restaurants, to schools. There's a whole movement of farm to school, and so Again, this is good for the environment. This is good for a small businessman, a small farmer. And I know I've been to the Madison Farmers Market, and we have an equivalently great one here in Ithaca. They can become huge tourist attractions and create jobs that way. So I think that this whole issue of local agriculture is a real positive aspect of what's going on in rural America.
And we leave it there. David, thank you so much for joining us. That was David Brown, International Professor of Development Sociology at Cornell University, joining us to talk about the different communities that live outside of American cities and the release of new census data on the realities of rural America. This is Central Time.
Some serious cold weather is hitting Wisconsin this week, but there's a silver lining to this cold weather cloud. We could see an ice palace and an ice castle open up in the next couple of weeks.
The Wisconsin Dells is scheduled to host an ice castle made by growing about 10,000 icicles a day. They say the floor will be made so you don't slip on it, you don't fall, which could be a problem to look out for in ice castles, but we'll see if it gets up and running.
And the famous ice palace in Eagle River could make a comeback this year, made out of 3,000 12-inch ice blocks. We've talked about the ice palace on the show before. It didn't get built, it looks like, last year because the ice never really got thick enough. I still haven't been to an ice palace or ice castle. Have you?
I haven't, but it is definitely on my to-do list. I've read about, what is it, there's supposed to be an ice hotel in, what is it, Canada or Finland?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're about the same, right?
Canada, a northern place.
A northern place where there's snow and ice. And yeah, it's on my to-do list for sure.
And then the big question in the Wisconsin Dells is, are they going to have flowing water slides on the ice castle?
The answer, Avi, of course they'll have.
Of course, yeah, on a mat or no mat. That might be a little bit chilly. So let us know if you are planning to go to an ice castle or ice palace. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and leave us a message. This is Central Time.
Collaborate and listen. Ice is back with a brand new invention. Something